So we turn in our Bibles tonight to the fifth chapter of the book of Genesis as we continue our study through the Bible. And again, we encourage you to read the Bible all the way through and come and study with us on Sunday evenings as we go through the Bible. Chapter 5 begins with, "This is the book of the genealogy or generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them, male and female, and blessed them, and called them mankind in the day that they were created." So we come now to the generations of Adam. It is interesting, this verse begins much as does the Gospel of Matthew, only Matthew begins with the words, "This is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ." And the same idea of tracing the lineage of Christ in Matthew's Gospel back to Abraham to show that he was the promised seed of Abraham. Now, as we deal with these genealogies, we're going to find some interesting things. And I think that one thing that is important to note, that the Bible is only interested in tracing, at this point, the line from Adam to Noah. Later on, it'll trace it from Adam to Abraham. And then later from Abraham to David, and then from David to Jesus Christ. But we are only interested in one family, and that is the one that will lead us to Jesus Christ. Now, in some places we may branch off a little bit into some of the family trees, but then it'll be cut off, even as we've already studied seven generations or so of Cain, but then that's cut off. We're not interested in Cain's descendants. We are only interested in coming to the line that'll bring us to Jesus Christ. Thus, the sons and the daughters are not named. That the son was the firstborn son is a wrong assumption, not necessarily so. It could have been the 16th son, but it is the one that will bring us to Noah, and that's the line we're interested in. And so when it says they lived 160 years old and they had a son, well, we aren't interested in all of the other children born up to this point. We're interested in this one that's going to lead us to Noah. And so we are going to trace the generations of Adam now on down to Noah. Adam lived 130 years, and he begot a son in his own likeness. Now notice verse 1, it tells us that God created Adam in his likeness. But now Adam is begetting sons in his own likeness, but no longer necessarily the likeness of God, because from that Adam fell when he sinned. And now death entered into the world, and death by sin, so that death passed unto all men. So his son was born with an Adamic nature, or a sinful nature, a nature that was governed by the flesh, the body appetites, whereas Adam originally was governed by the spirit and inclined towards God. Now he begets a son in his own likeness, born with a sinful nature, born after the flesh, who has to now be redeemed. In the beginning, Adam didn't need redemption. Not until the fall was redemption necessary. So this, of course, we know is not the first son of Adam. It could have been the 57th son of Adam. After all, he's been married for 130 years. And in those days, conditions were much better for raising children than they are today. And so he bore now a son, though, when he was 130 years old, and he named him Seth. They looked to Seth as the replacement, really, for Abel, who was killed by his older brother Cain. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he begot sons and daughters, so that Adam lived to be 930 years old. Now, if you will follow along, you'll find it very interesting. Adam living to be 930 years old means that Adam was still alive when Lamech was born, who is the father of Noah. So Adam lived almost until the time of the birth of Noah. He died not long before Noah's birth. Adam and Enoch lived together on the earth at the same time. In fact, Enoch was translated not too many years after Adam's death. We sometimes, because there were so many generations, we fail to realize that because of the longevity, these people are not as far removed as you might think. So that Adam lived contemporaneously with Lamech for 100 years. Noah's father was probably around 100 years old or so when Adam died. So the whole story of creation could have been passed directly from Adam to Lamech, who in turn passed it to his son Noah. And then Noah to his son Shem, who was still alive at the time that Abraham was born. So Abraham, you see, isn't that far removed from the story. And these early generations of Adam were probably recorded by Abraham, who heard them from his great-great-great-grandfather Seth, who heard them from his father Noah, who heard them from Lamech, who heard them from Adam himself. And so we're not really passing too many transmissions to bring the story directly to Abraham. And so Seth lived 105 years and he begot Enosh, as I say, not necessarily his firstborn, but it is the one that we are interested in because he is the one who is in the line that will bring us to Noah. And then it goes on and speaks of the various generations that came along. And we're not going to read them until we get to Jared, verse 18, who lived 162 years, and he begot Enoch. And after he begot Enoch, Jared lived 800 years. He begot sons and daughters, so all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. And Enoch lived 65 years, and he begot Methuselah. Now, Enoch is a very interesting one in this line because Enoch did not die, but he was translated that he might not see death. But before he was translated, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it is impossible to please God, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. This is the testimony of Enoch in Hebrews chapter 11 when we are dealing with the hall of faith. Those men of the Old Testament who believed God and whose names were inscribed upon the hall of faith of men who believed and trusted in God. And so Enoch, who is called the eighth from Adam in Jude, is translated, he does not see death, but he lived 65 years and he begot Methuselah. Now, according to Jude, Enoch was a prophet. And he prophesied actually of the coming of Jesus Christ. In Jude we are told, "Behold, Enoch," and he was the seventh from Adam, prophesied saying, "Behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment upon the earth." And so the prophecies of judgment, the judgment of God that must come upon the earth. He named his son Methuselah, which name means when he dies, judgment. Sort of signifying that the judgment of God, of which Enoch was prophesying, would come upon the earth in the year of the death of his son Methuselah. And so after he begot Methuselah, he walked with God 300 years and begot sons and daughters. And the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. So Enoch was raptured before the flood ever came, before the judgment of God was visited upon the earth. He walked with God by faith and was raptured. And of course, we are told by faith Enoch was raptured that he should not see death. And so it was by faith that Enoch was caught away. Now, because Enoch shares with Elijah the similar fate of not dying, but being translated directly into heaven, and because it is appointed unto man once to die, many Bible scholars believe that Enoch will be one of the two witnesses of Revelation 11, that during the first part of the 7 years that God has determined yet upon the nation of Israel, that they will be prophesying together, Enoch and Elijah, two of the dominant prophets of the Old Testament, coming back upon the earth to prophesy to Israel during the first part of this last 7-year cycle. And that we know from the book of Revelation, the Antichrist will put them to death, and their bodies will lie in the streets of Jerusalem for 3 days as the whole world watches, no doubt by satellite TV, and rejoices, and then God revives them and they ascend directly up into heaven in the eyes of all of the people of the earth. And so, because these are the two men from the Old Testament who did not make their appointment with death, there are many who believe that these are the two witnesses that will come yet again. And of course, we do know that Elijah is one of them, for the Lord shall send Elijah before the great notable day of the Lord to turn the hearts of the children unto their fathers. And that is the prophecy in Malachi. But Enoch is thought to be the other of the two. Interesting man. Now Methuselah, his son, when he dies, judgment, lived 187 years, and he begot Lamech. And after he begot Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years, and he begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. Lamech lived 182 years, and he begot a son and called his name Noah. And this is the, you know, the one that we've been tracing down to, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and toil of our hands." The word Noah means rest, because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. And after he begot Noah, Lamech lived for 595 years, and he begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died, and Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That was in this first 500 years. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, we pointed out this morning that the time of Noah was a time of population explosion. And you can make a very fascinating and interesting study of the population growth. You have to have above zero population, or the earth is going to be extinct of man. And so the population growth factor, it seems, has been about 1.5 from the time of Noah to the present time. But prior to the flood, if we assume that the average generation was 94 years, and that the average family size was 8 children, and that the average age was 500 years old, though those that we have listed average out at 912. But if we say the average was 500 years, 8 children, and 94 years making a generation, at that rate, at the time of Noah's flood, there were 137 billion people living on the face of the earth. Now, there are some very interesting discoveries, especially in the area in South America, Peru, in the Andes, the area of Lake Titicaca, which is the highest large body of water in the world, way up there in the Andes. These mountain peaks in the Andes that go up to 20,000 feet or so, there is evidence that at one time on the shores of Lake Titicaca, there was a huge metropolis. And the Andean mountains around this area are terraced for farming far above the level where you can farm today, on up into above the tree levels. There are still the terraces which were once farmed. They, in fact, go right up into the glacial ice and under the glacial ice, which leads to the conclusion by those that have been making the study of the geological structures and the farms and all and the terraces on these Andean hillsides, that once and not that long ago, the Andean mountains were at sea level. Lake Titicaca was at sea level, but was thrust upwards in a gigantic earth movement. And it is interesting that they do date the time of this at around 5,000 years ago. Now, if indeed the population of the earth had expanded, men began to multiply on the face of the earth, that men had, of course, expanded over all of the land surface of the earth by that time. And surely there is evidence that men lived before the flood age in great numbers down in South America. It is also possible that the continental shift took place sometime later. That originally the earth was all one landmass, so that these areas and the things that puzzle us today from a geological standpoint have resulted from the flood. But we do have evidence of vast civilizations of people who lived on a very high level of civilization, existed in varied parts of the world. In the book Earth's in Upheaval by Emanuel Velikovsky, he deals in a short segment with this Lake Titicaca and the mysteries that surround this lake as far as the tremendous population that once existed there in the Peruvian Andes. And again, pointing out that all of the evidence indicates that it was at sea level at one time, not too many years ago. Men were multiplying upon the face of the earth, and the daughters were born to them, and the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they choose. Now it would appear that the sons of God here is a reference to angels, to fallen angels. The term sons of God, Bar Elohim, in the Old Testament are used of angels in many cases. The classic case, of course, in the book of Job, and the sons of God were presenting themselves to God, and Satan also came with them. So we are dealing now with abnormal sex, as these fallen angels, and of course it could be that these are the ones that Peter is referring to, that are reserved in the chains of Tartarus. And that is the only place in the Bible where Tartarus is mentioned, but it is mentioned in classical Greek. And as in classical Greek, they say as Hades is below the earth, so Tartarus is below Hades. But we are told that these angels are waiting in chains in Tartarus. Jude speaks of the angels which kept not their first estate, but are being reserved in chains of darkness, awaiting the day of judgment. The problem that people often bring up at this point is that when the Sadducees brought to Jesus a hypothetical question, by which they sought to discount the idea of the resurrection, they said to Jesus, there was a certain man who married a wife and he died without any children, and his brother took her as his wife and he died without any children. The next brother took her, he died without any children, until at last all seven brothers had her for their wife. They all died without any children. Now in the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? And Jesus said, you do err because you don't understand the resurrection, the things of God. For in the resurrection we will be as the angels who neither marry nor are given in marriage. He did not say that angels do not have a capacity for sex. Those angels that appeared in the Old Testament did appear as men when they made an appearance in a human form. You remember when they came to the city of Sodom, the men of Sodom came and began to beat on the door of Lot, saying, let them come out to us that we might know them. They wanted to abuse them sexually, thinking that they were mortal men. It is hard, almost impossible, to read the sons of God here as being the sons of Seth, the godly line of Seth, marrying the ungodly line of Cain. That is a forced interpretation, and it doesn't really fit. Though we may not understand it completely, it would appear that there was a cohabiting between fallen angels and women. And the product, of course, was giants from this genetic engineering. Those that were born of them were gigantic. I had the other week up here a cast of a footprint that was found in the Palexi River down in Texas alongside of several dinosaur tracks. This footprint that I have, the cast of the footprint, indicates a man some 8 feet tall. I have a tennis shoe in my office that is a size 16. And the tennis shoe fits completely. This man could not have worn the tennis shoe. His toe, he had to cut a hole in the end for his toe to stick out. And from the size of the footprint, the man is estimated to be some 8 feet tall. Huge. The product, perhaps, that footprint cast that I have, could very well be the product, the byproduct of what we read here in Genesis, because the footprint was fossilized alongside of dinosaur prints there in the Paluxy River, and it could be that they were, both of them perished in the flood. And at that time, the dinosaurs, being too big to get into the ark, became extinct. Sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful. They took wives for themselves of all that they chose. And so it was a time of abnormal sexual activity. There is a very interesting case, history, from the Philippines of a young Filipino girl by the name of Teresa, who would go into seizures and scream during these seizures, after which bite marks would appear on her body. And you might immediately surmise, well, she was biting herself during the seizure. However, there were bite marks on the back of her neck and on her back, where it would have been impossible for her to bite herself. She was finally placed in the Bilibid prison under protective custody, as some of the finest psychiatrists in the Philippines were brought to examine her. They were unable to do anything to stop these seizures, and so finally, two missionaries, Lester Summerall and the name of the other missionary escapes me right now. That's right. He married a gal I used to go with. I should remember that. But I've been trying to forget that one for a long time. And they were called to exorcise the demon from this girl. And it's an extremely bizarre account of the exorcism. It's been written up in a little book called Bitten by Demons. Her case history was written up in either Look or Life magazine. That's where I first came across it. But at the time I read about it in the Look magazine, her life, it was just one of those bizarre incidents, and there was no solution at that time. Later, the demons were exorcised by these two missionaries. After Teresa was set free from these demons that were harassing, molest, and according to her own word, they were sexually molesting her, and that they would attack her when any men would approach her. And that was her story, finally, to Lester Sumrall. It's an extremely bizarre story, and yet pretty well documented and attested to. I've talked personally with both Bob McAllister and Lester Sumrall about it. But she spoke of sexual molestation by these demons. And cases of sexual molestation by demons are quite common in the records of missionaries from China and from areas where the gospel of Jesus Christ has not had a strong impact. Here at the time of Noah, tremendous satanic activity, satanic worship, the opening up of a person to satanic possession. To me, it is shocking, it is alarming, it is frightening that we have such a tremendous interest today in Satanism. And satanic worship centers are springing up all over the United States. Witches' covens are quite common. Here in Orange County, there's a multitude of them. But it's really no wonder, because the children in our grade schools here in the public schools of Orange County can check out of their grade school libraries books on Satanism, books on witchcraft, and how to get started dabbling in that area of witchcraft and Satanism. How to become a witch for the little children, third and fourth grade levels, right in the libraries of our grade schools here in Orange County. It would be impossible to put a book in there, How to Become a Christian. You see, that's against the law, as interpreted by the Supreme Court. And so the tremendous rise in Satanism, 2020, of course, had that program on this last Thursday night, which was also bizarre and shocking, in which they related the 2 million children, babies, that disappear every year with the practice of the human sacrifice that goes on in these satanic circles. And they had little boys, 12 years old, testifying of how that the ones who were tutoring them in satanic worship held their hands and helped them to push the knives into these little bodies and kill these little children. It was a very shocking and horrifying thing. Thursday night on 2020. Unbelievable. You say, that can't happen here. It is happening here. A tremendous interest in the occult. Well, look at what the kids are being fed on TV every Saturday morning, as you're relieved that they're not under your feet. And they're in there watching Zartan and Zoltar and all of these occultic creatures. They're seeing monsters that have been genetically engineered. That's why on Saturday morning on K-Wave, we started broadcasting the children's albums and children's programs so that you have an alternative to the junk that they are being fed on TV. You talk about violence. Man, I've never seen such violence as in the cartoons. Man, they flatten them out and they blow them to pieces. They always seem to come back, but man, what violence, you know. And look how we are glutting the children's minds with these things. You often wonder, what's it going to produce in the next generation? What will be the fruit? As the prophet said, you have sowed the wind, and now you must reap the whirlwind. And we've been sowing the wind, and we've begun to reap the whirlwind. The Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever. For he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. God is not probably there putting a limit on age, so much as he is declaring that in 120 years, he's going to bring his judgment and wipe out the earth unless there is a repentance, unless there's a change. And it was probably 120 years from this time that God brought his judgment. His days are numbered, God is saying. He's got 120 years. Now, there were giants on the earth in those days, the byproducts of the genetic engineering and the cohabiting with the sons of God and the daughters of men. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them, they were the mighty men who were of old, the Nephilims, the men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Man's minds have become so completely polluted that in his imagination, it was only evil. Evil thoughts continually. The Bible tells us that whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. If you sow to your flesh, you're going to have your flesh reap corruption. If you sow to the Spirit, you're going to reap life everlasting. But God help us. Every place you go, there are things that sow to your flesh. The billboards, advertisements, all designed to appeal to the flesh, to attract the attention of the flesh. But in these days, it's even worse, because you can go and rent a video, or you can subscribe for the various Select and On and Playboy channels, whereby you can bring all kinds of pornography into your home, which will plant and be planted into your mind and will feed the flesh, which will help your imagination of your mind to be filthy and evil continually. That was the condition that existed when God said, my spirit will not always strive with man. It's enough. I've had it. This interest in Satanism, this abnormal sexual activity, the evil of the imagination of man's hearts. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it was grievous in his heart. He was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and animal, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. In the midst of a wicked and a perverse generation, one man stood out, Noah. He found grace in the eyes of the Lord. By faith, Noah walked with God. And this is the genealogy or the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. That is probably referring to a pureness. In other words, there was no admixture with these sons of God and daughters of men. There was a pure strain here. The whole world was becoming corrupt by the abnormal sexual relationships and genetic engineering. But here was a pure line. He was pure in his generations. Noah walked with God, and he begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And so conditions that had resulted out of the breakdown of the family, marriage and divorce, marrying and giving in marriage, the breakdown of the family unit, and the social chaos, violence, and corruption filling the earth. So God looked on the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. The word translated pitch is the Hebrew word kofar. It is the same word translated later as atonement, as the blood of the lamb would make a kofar for the sins, a covering for the sins. So the ark was to be covered inside and out with this kofar, probably a resin base kind of a pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits. Generally, a cubit is thought to be approximately 18 inches, the distance from your elbow to the tip of your finger. Now they had the span, which was the length from your thumb to your finger, and so you would measure out so many spans and so many cubits. And that was a very simple and quick way of measurement. 300 cubits would translate into about 450 feet. So half again as long as a football field. It was to be 50 cubits wide or 75 feet wide. And the height 30 cubits or 45 feet. There were to be three decks. And so that means the height within each deck was probably 15 feet. As far as volumetric capacity, it was 1,400,000 cubic feet. I said this morning 126 boxcars. Actually, you could take 522 boxcars that they haul livestock on today and fit them in the ark. 522 boxcars. Now, in a boxcar, they can put 124 sheep, which means that he could have had 125,000 sheep in that ship. But he only had 7 pair, because they were of the clean animal, and 7 pair of each clean animal, 1 pair of the unclean animal that went into the ark. But, of course, he didn't have to take the fish into the ark. They could survive the flood. There were certain birds that it would not be necessary to take them into the ark. Those birds that are adapted to the water, they could have survived. But of the species, now he didn't have to take all, you know, a bunch of dogs in there. All he had to have is 1 pair of dogs. He didn't have to have, you know, the dachshunds and the Samoyeds and the various types of dogs, but just 1 pair of dogs. You have the species, the dog family, you have the cat family, and just 1 pair of each species that were brought into the ark. With 1,400,000 cubic feet of space, or enough for 522 livestock cattle cars that they have on trains, there would have been sufficient room for a pair of all of the major species of animals that we have on the earth today. I'm only sorry that the 2 flies got in there. They bug me. But it is quite possible that the dinosaurs didn't make it, and that is what accounts for the extinction of the dinosaurs. Now, our minds have been conditioned by the evolutionary teachings that we have had in our various classes through high school and college, as we've studied geology and anthropology and biology and all. And our minds have been so mentally conditioned to the evolutionary hypothesis that we somehow believe that the dinosaurs became extinct some 300 million years ago. I saw a picture in the paper just this last week of some paleontologist who was examining the skeleton of a little dinosaur. And according to the article, the skeleton of the dinosaur that he was examining was the oldest dinosaur that's ever been discovered. They say that every time they find a new skeleton. While I was living in Tucson, I had a very interesting man, Dr. Albro, who took a liking to me. He had been a professor of anthropology and of ancient history at the University of Minnesota. And he took upon himself to tutor me in some of these subjects that he taught at the university. And we spent many marvelous evenings together poring over the books. And at that time, one of the archaeology classes at the University of Arizona was conducting some diggings outside of Tucson, and they announced that they had discovered the oldest skeletons of Indians ever found, and they were estimated to be some 10,000 years old or something, you know. And I said, "What about this, Dr. Albro? The age of these, you know, fossils, or the age of these bones that they're discovering and all. You know, how do they really determine the age?" He said, "You want to know the truth?" I said, "Of course." He said, "All right." He said, "Let us assume that you and I are out here digging through the dirt in excavating a site that was once an Indian village." He said, "If we come across a skeleton, and if I, as a archaeologists and all examine that skeleton, if I say, well, that Indian must have lived probably 3,000 years ago, and he was so old when he died, and he died as a result of a skull fracture because, you know, you can see where his skull was bashed and so forth. He said, 3,000 years, they've already discovered Indians 3,000 years old. So if I announce the discovery of this skeleton, who's going to pay any attention? They've already got him 3,000 years old. So he said, I have to find out what is the oldest claim for the skeletons they have found so far. And then I've got to make mine a few years older than that, because then the newspapers will pick it up and it becomes news, because now you found the oldest one. And he said, it's all a big hype to get the newspapers to report it so that you can attract money for your further excavations. He said, you want to get money, grants, and also that you can go on with your excavation. So he said, you date it a little older than the last guy so that it becomes the oldest. And so when I saw this picture of this guy examining this little dinosaur, and it said, the oldest dinosaur yet discovered, I thought, oh man, they're still at the same game, you know. But dinosaurs were probably not taken on the ark, but dinosaurs did coexist with man, as is plainly evident there at the Paluxy River in Texas, where every day they are uncovering more and more fossilized footprints of dinosaurs and men side by side, parallel, and in some places the man's footprint crosses into the dinosaur's track, and he's left his footprint right in the middle of the dinosaur's track. Do you know that some of the archaeologists and paleontologists have tried to destroy that site? And were successful in destroying a large part of it, but they just recently uncovered a whole new area. Because you see, according to the evolutionary hypothesis, that can't be. That's destructive. And so men who are intent upon keeping God out of the scene, rationalizing for the existence of man without God, are trying to destroy the clear evidence that destroys completely the hoax and the lie that they've been trying to foster onto the gullible public. Now, not all scientists and evolutionists are hucksters. Some of them are very sincere, but they are sincerely deceived. They are beginning with false presuppositions, and their conclusions are all based upon a certain presuppositional base, of course, that evolution is a scientifically proved fact and that the earth is 12 billion years old, and so they try to interpret all of the evidence with that presuppositional base, and thus they've got things all confused. Lyell, who was the father of the uniformitarianism concept from which the evolutionary hypothesis was born, Lyell visited the United States and visited the Niagara Falls and saw the gorge that's been created as Lake Erie drops over and forms then Lake Superior. And as he examined the gorge created by the Niagara Falls, and he talked to the people back in 1797 who were living near the area, they told him at that time that the falls were receding at about 4 feet a year. But that didn't fit with his hypotheses, and so he went back and told the world that the falls were receding at 1 foot a year. And so that 30,000 foot gorge then took 30,000 years to form, and that fit more with his theories of uniformitism. However, since 1797, and he called attention of the world to that gorge, they have been measuring it, and they found that it does recede at the rate of 4.5 feet per year since 1797. And that the inhabitants of the area were more correct than he. But at the earlier recession of the glacial ice that once formed the waters of the lakes, the flow of water was probably greater in those earlier years, and so it is safe to assume that the erosion rate in earlier years was greater than it was today because of the greater volume of water that was pouring over it in the earlier period of the glacial recession. Now, at 4.5 feet per year, it makes the beginning of the creation of the Niagara Falls something like 5,000 to 6,000 years ago. Which is quite interesting, because now we're coming close to the time of the flood. Again, this is all brought out in the book Earth in Upheaval by Emmanuel Velikovsky. And as far as a man who doesn't really believe the Bible as necessarily the Word of God, he thinks it is a very interesting, and as far as he's been able to ascertain, accurate accounting of events. But he gives more solid scientific proof of the young earth since the last glacial or ice age than anything I've ever read. And he has thrown really tremendous curves at the evolutionists and the uniformitarianists that have postulated this long earth in order to, or long ages to fit with their worn-out theories. So the flood can very easily account for a lot of the coal deposits, the mammoths frozen in the ice in the Siberian tundra, with the various upheavals and the lack of a real pattern in a geological column. God commanded him to make the ark. He makes a window above the ark and probably all the way around the top, 18 inches. Of course, with all those animals, you'd like some pretty good ventilation. And he set the door of the ark in the side. You'll make it with the lower, second, and third decks. And behold, God said, I myself am bringing the flood of waters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all of the flesh, which is the breath of life, and everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, and your sons and your wives, your sons' wives with you. Every living thing of all flesh you shall bring, two of every sort, into the ark. Keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female, of the birds after their kind, animals after their kind, creeping things of the earth after its kind. Two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive, will come to you. God put in the animals just sort of an instinctive kind of a thing that brought them to the ark and to Adam. It is interesting that they believe that animals, there are some animals that instinctively can predict earthquakes. They're watching the behavior of animals, and it seems like there's an abnormal behavior before an earthquake, and that maybe they know something that we don't know, or they can sense something that we can't sense. There are interesting things about the instinctive capacities of animals. And you shall take for yourself of all of the food that is eaten. Gather it to yourself. It will be for food for you and for them. Noah did all according to all that God commanded him, so he did. Actually, remember, he had to have enough food to feed all the animals and feed himself for about a year. But still, there's plenty of room in the ark for it all. If you want to just sit down and really figure it out, cubic feet-wise and so forth, he had sufficient room. And so he got in the ark, and next week we'll find out what happens once he got inside as we continue on in chapter 7. May the Lord be with you and watch over you during the week, and may God keep you unspotted from this evil world in which we live. As Paul said to Timothy, my son Timothy, flee ungodly lust. There is so much to stimulate you in this world in which we live. To start to feed the mind and to lead it into fantasies of unrighteousness and unreality. It's so easy that our imaginations be directed toward evil and evil things. Keep your mind pure. Keep your heart pure. Walk with God in close fellowship. Give no place to the enemy. Walk in purity and righteousness in fellowship with God through Jesus. And thus may you have a glorious week walking in the Spirit. For they that are in the Spirit shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. May you be in the Spirit. In Jesus' name.